This podcast is dedicated to the memory of David Lavery, who is a well-loved and major contributor to the vast scholarship world of Twin Peaks. David Lavery passed away on August 30th of this year. He is known for Full of Secrets, Critical Approaches to Twin Peaks, for which he was editor, as well as other works regarding Joss Whedon, Seinfeld, X-Files, Deadwood, and The Sopranos.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another edition of Sparkwood and 21. Tonight, we have a little bit of reviews for you. We have a little bit of feedback for you. So without any further ado, let's get started. This is a No Shit Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I am your host, Em. Okay, so before we get into the meat of the podcast, I just want to make an announcement. We now have a membership link that is allotted to those who contribute financially to our podcast. I have sent out notices via your email address. So if you have been one who has contributed financially to us, check your email. And if you check your email and you haven't gotten anything from me, please let me know at noshipnetwork@gmail.com. All right. So we actually just have one review. We're reviewing a podcast called Diane. And you can find them at Diane Podcast on Twitter. You can also find them at their website, diane.libsyn.com. They've been brought to my attention by our listener, John Bernardi, who's a huge fan of the Diane podcast. And I started my Twin Peaks rewatch in preparation for the 2017 season today. And I watched the pilot episode this morning. And so I decided to go ahead and start listening to the Diane podcast as I did my rewatch. And I listened to the part one of their pilot coverage, and I was immediately taken with them because I'm a sucker for British accents, first of all. But there's more to them than that. They're very intelligent, disarming. They really dig deep into their discussions. In fact, I think that's why they have a part one and part two of the pilot. And as a podcaster, I really appreciate their format. They use music cleverly as a way to segue or transition when they're going from one subject to another. So instead of just having this drop, like this sudden drop off, it has this nice smooth transition with the way they use music. In some instances where they I think have a interesting approach is that maybe also because they're British as well, they didn't know what homecoming was, so they researched it. And that was really interesting for me as an American to listen to that. And I even learned from it. But it also brought some depth to their analysis of Twin Peaks, especially when they talked about what Laura represent being the homecoming queen. So I don't want to give that away, but I thought that was really cool and you guys should check it out. And they also go into, for instance, like the history of logging and how it relates to the introduction or the journey of Laura's corpse as well, which I thought was really, really interesting. Also, I am starting my rewatch and I watched the pilot this morning and it was interesting for me this time around because I feel like I know it so much that I'm looking at other things like backgrounds. Like I love Ben Horn's boat lamp. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But it made me regret not rewatching it all and then starting our podcast because there's a conversation that Cooper has on, you know, to Diane when they're examining Laura's corpse and he discovers the R under her finger and he says, "Don't give it to Sam, give it to Albert and his team. They're more on the ball." And it's like, oh, that's Sam Stanley he's talking about, played by Kiefer Sutherland from Fire Walk With Me. Stuff like that we missed, but hindsight's 20/20, as they say. Also, James looks super suspicious. I don't know why, but he just looks like the killer to me, even though I know he's not. But he just, if it was me watching the show for the first time right now in the phase of my life right now, I'd be like, oh, it's him.
Okay, so maybe we should just, you know, reverse a little bit and give him some acting credit here because everybody was supposed to look suspicious in the pilot because you just didn't know who did it yet, especially if you're watching it obviously when it airs for the first time.
Well, he's coming back. He's one of the cast members coming back. And I don't really have any Twin Peaks news, but I, you know, we haven't actually talked about the huge list of actors that they had put out a while back, which I'm sure all of you are aware of. And I was thinking about it today. It's like, you got all these cameos, possible cameos of all these musicians that are going to be in it.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe they'll all be Bookhouse Boys or something like that, which would be cool. I can see Eddie Vedder as a Bookhouse Boy.
Eddie Vedder's going to be in it?
That's
one of the people?
Yeah.
Interesting. See, I have faith that David Lynch is going to do it right. I have faith that Mark Frost is going to do it right, and they're going to demand that it be done right. And, you know, the ball is in their court as far as that's concerned. They're not going to have to kowtow to some sort of, you know, network imperatives about giving the reveal for the killer. Everybody's learned that lesson, and we've all moved on. So Lynch and Frost get their creative control. But if you were an actor or a musician and you grew up with Twin Peaks, or you at least understood the significance that it had culturally, you would want to be in it. So, you know, you've probably got the pick of the litter. You've just got people lined up around the block wanting to remember the scene in Annie when everybody was going to get the check for however many, you know, Daddy Warbucks had the check for whoever was going to be Annie's real parents.
Lynch is like, Daddy Warbucks now. Okay.
Yeah. And there's all these people just going back. And Daddy Warbucks says, I didn't realize that there were so many dishonest people in New York, which is kind of a stupid thing to say. But anyway, I mean, it's New York City. But hopefully these people can act. Hopefully they can bring something to it. And they're not like, dude, I'm going to be in Twin Peaks. Can you fucking believe it? Kind of thing. So Eddie Vedder would have to be a bookhouse boy to have that pulled off. Or else he would have to actually show some real acting skills and sort of pull off a role that you wouldn't even know that it was him. Like somebody would have to tell you later on that, mm-hmm. Hey, see that guy right there who's giving the letter to this person or whatever the action might be? That was Eddie Vedder.
Yeah, he could be some strange denizen of the lodge and you can't even really make out his face because he's wearing some creepy mask or something.
That's what I would want to do. That would be fun to me.
Yeah.
You know, like nobody would actually be able to recognize you, but you could tell. And then I would just never tell anybody that I was in it, but I would know.
All right. So we're going to go ahead and get into some feedback, miscellaneous feedback that has kind of been collected over the past couple months. And we're going to start with Carl Eckler, who wrote into us at the time of the interviews that we were recording. And he's a friend of Jubal. And he wrote these awesome letters to us that were in this beautiful green penmanship. And he sent them to us digitally by taking photos of them via Twitter. I want to share those now. Carl Eckler says, apologies for the longhand. I think best with a pen in hand. Let me know if it is utterly unreadable, and I'll send a sound file instead. First off, I love your show. My good friend Jubal turned me on to your work about a year ago now. Very good deconstruction and analysis of the show itself, Fire Walk With Me, The Missing Pieces, and the tie-in books and other Ephraima. I enjoyed your interview with Joel Bacco, and I am looking forward to hearing more interviews in the series. Now, this is my first write-in to a podcast. I meant to chime in while you were in the middle of your rewatch, but never quite got up the gumption, as Pete Martell might word it. On reflection, there are a few things I would like to add and a, well, let's call it a watching philosophy for Twin Peaks that I would like to expound. At one point in the show, Cooper makes a reference to the Tri-Cities. Given the clues for the town's location mentioned elsewhere, these particular Tri-Cities could only be the cities of Richland, Pasco, and Kennewich, located at the confluence of the Columbia and Snake Rivers in southeastern Washington state. This is a place I can claim to know fairly well. I was from there and lived near a small desert community some 25 miles away until the age of 7. Now, this seems a minor detail, but like most things Lynchian, the rabbit hole goes all the way down. I became slightly obsessed with working out the real-world location of Twin Peaks during the 90s because, except for the poodle skirts and saddle shoes, it was very near in weirdness and in stated location to the town Jubal and I started out our high school terms. A few problems with this identification. Colville is an order of magnitude smaller than Twin Peaks, 5,000 versus 50,000 residents. Yeah, so originally Twin Peaks was supposed to be just over 5,000, but it was the network that wanted it 50,000 because they didn't think it was relatable.
I can see that. I can see why they would make a call like that to a certain extent, but they didn't really follow through. Like the writing didn't bear that out because I always felt like it was a much smaller town than 50,000 residents.
That's because that's what the writers intended.
Yeah, so they never changed it. All they changed was the population number.
So Carl goes on to say, it's near the highway too, Cooper mentions, but not on it. It's farther away from both the state line and the Canadian border than Cooper describes, etc., etc. However, as soon as Google Maps came on the scene, the answer became clear. Twin Peaks did not exist.
Very good.
There are no lakes that span the U.S.-Canadian border in Washington, Idaho, or Montana until one goes as far east as Glacier National Park. Those are too far from any town, as well as too far east, to make sense as a means of reaching One-Eyed Jack's from the Great Northern. And so I had to admit that Frost and Lynch had invented Twin Peaks by combining a number of influences updated for a 90s audience. Chicago under Prohibition, the Spokane, Lumberton of Blue Velvet, and Lynchian's childhood in Missoula, Montana. I think this was done on purpose. Twin Peaks states as an actual utopia, no place, allows it to function as a type of Axis Mundi or World Navel, a special and magical place, more so even than Tahiti, which is written as an acronym, and I feel like I should know what that is.
I don't know either. You got me on that one.
Where travel is possible to the underworld, the dream time, or the universal unconsciousness. Characters frequently refer to Twin Peaks as a special place, and we notice it, too. The mix of new and old fashions, the characters even quirkier than a season of Portlandia, the natural beauty, all this goes to prove that we are not dealing with a regular murder mystery. Twin Peaks is not The Killing, set 20 years earlier. It is, in my opinion, the first really postmodern TV show. My lit professor once broke down the last 150 years of literary theory somewhat like this. Romanticism. Art is about beauty. Realism. Art is about how things actually are. Modernism. Art is about holding a mirror up to life. Postmodernism. Art is about warping and then smashing that mirror into a thousand pieces. The reader/viewer/listener may then put those pieces together however they like. That last bit, I believe, is what makes Twin Peaks so special. The very lack of specificity engineered by Lynch and Frost allows us to construct the answer to what is really going on for ourselves. In short, the greatest gift to us is the very vagueness that they are sometimes criticized for. For this gift, we the fans must repay with the hope of future mystery. That is my fondest desire for the third season. May each answer lead to another two questions. Both in terms of characterization and mythology. I mean the same when it comes to our fan theories. Some few may be disproven, but most exist along a continuum of possibilities so vast that impossible cannot seem, nor abject certainty sounded from any known print. It is for this reason that I enjoy any theory I hear while ranking as most believable these I like best. But it seems as though most of the thinkers on the Twin Peaks enigma feel the same, or close enough to this condition that a similar equanimity of ideas has evolved, so my warning and advice is superfluous. Also, you people are just so damn nice that stereotypically nasty ivory tower argument simply doesn't happen. For that, I am most grateful. Sincerely, Carl B. Trouble Eckler.
Thanks, Carl. That's a really good compliment, because I feel like we actually live up to that. Thank you. I have a hard time taking compliments seriously, not seriously, but I have a hard time taking them to heart. But that one I can really kind of gel with, because I don't feel like we make ivory tower arguments. I think we're the exact opposite of that. We're down there in the dirt and the gravel.
Well, I mean, I like to stay open to possibilities. He has a PS and he says, I am currently engaged in a daily rewatch of Twin Peaks, followed by re-listening to a corresponding episode of your podcast. Having just finished the pilot, I recall you're asking for a rationale for Cooper and Truman's seizure of a package of small chocolate bunnies. I suspect Lynchian weirdness is the primary reason, but keep in mind that such treats are frequently hollow, and what is hollow may be filled with any number of chemical contrabands.
Oh.
Yep.
Good call,
yes,
Carl.
Yes, thank you for that.
I like that.
And we have one more from Carl. All right. Dear No Shippers, at one point in your coverage of Twin Peaks, you mentioned that if the series would have carried on into a third season in the 1990s, Major Briggs and the Blue Book outer space UFO angle to the show's mythology would be explained more fully. I understand that this is somewhat controversial among the fan community, who rightly, I think, feel that something as science-based as aliens would clash with the themes that Twin Peaks so ably explored earlier in its run. Rather than add to any foment, I would like to draw your attention to a few interesting confluences between the UFO alien lore in real life and similar artifacts in the show. The owls are not what they seem. Of all the clues to the world behind this curtain of Twin Peaks, this is perhaps the most perplexing. Given Mark Frost's love of esoterica, however, I find it unlikely that there is no connection between this utterance and the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case, where prior to hypnotic suggestion regression, Betty remembered not gray aliens, but owls with red glowing eyes pursuing them through the woods. After 6 months of work by a psychologist practicing regression hypnotherapy, the couple did recall the big eyes, small mouth folks from the Zeta Reticuli that Spielberg made famous in Close Encounters. But prior to this, they were bog standard giant owls with freaky eyes, not with a number of reports out of Point Pleasant, West Virginia in the mid-1960s. But yes, before becoming famous as the Mothman, that entity was described as a large and with burning red eyes. Now you're going into the Mothman, which really scared the crap out of me, that movie. That disturbed me greatly. Now, those owls were certainly not what they seem, and interpretation of what all this means, if one elects not to utilize Occam's razor, leads to some very strange territory indeed. John Keel, first in his The Mothman Prophecies and further explained in earlier books, termed these strange visitors not extraterrestrials but ultraterrestrials, beings native to another dimension or mode of existence for outside of our notions of how things should be. Jacques Vallée has also written on this topic, noting the similarities between UFO abduction reports and actual folklore of fairies. While to somewhat oversimplify, Vallée favors the interpretation that ultraterrestrials are products of the human subconscious or universal unconscious, and leans toward the belief that these beings are more traditional non-humans hailing from an alien world that exists even further away than the most distant star. Both interpretations would complement the Twin Peaks worldview tremendously. Consider the wonderful juxtapositions and absurdities that Lynch and Frost could create out of such grist as this. Also, such a view of the lodge denizens, to me at last, makes a great deal more sense than their actual origin being a physical planet made out of actual creamed corn. That particular interpretation cries out for an essay connecting Twin Peaks with Vampirella, an essay I think I will spare you or anyone else to the supreme honor of having to read. I don't know. I think it would be interesting to read. One thing, however, remains certain. No matter what the owls really are, I hope that they will be flying through the mist-shrouded mountains of Twin Peaks and into our mind's eye sometime in the 2017 miniseries, Yours in Coffee and Pie, Carl Beach Rebel Eckler.
That's a lot to take in right there about the whole extra-dimensional, possibly extraterrestrial, or ultra-terrestrial, as it's called. I don't really know. It does seem to make it mesh more with the supernatural legacy that was put forth towards the end, towards the middle and then end of the show. Because I understand where people are coming from if they feel a little bit of schism between those ideas. If they say, okay, well, you've got what Lynch or Frost or, you know, Lynch and Frost separately are trying to put forth at any given time that has to do with the supernatural elements of the show. But then you tie in Major Briggs' involvement with Project Blue Book and extraterrestrials and the whole nine yards. And you're like, okay, well, one of these is hard scientific fact that they're trying to deal with. And another one is dealing with the spirit world. So this ties them together nicely, I think, and makes it to where they can coexist. And that's where the theories really get interesting, is when you can make incongruous things or seemingly incongruous things sort of coexist on a plane together. I like that. And going back to earlier, what Carl was saying before about locations, about how Twin Peaks doesn't actually exist, because it ended up just being an amalgam of a bunch of different places somewhere in the northwestern part of the United States, right? So,
right.
I watched or was shown the pilot and Firewalk, or it was either, I always get it confused what I saw first, but the first little bits of Twin Peaks that I saw, including Firewalk with Me, I saw in Florida, which is a completely different landscape altogether than anything that you're going to see in this portion of Lynch's work. And then we moved to Boise, Idaho for 3.5 years in late 1999. And then I think somewhere in the middle of 2000, they came out with that very first VHS box set that we've talked about at length in the main body of our podcast at some point. And or at several points, I'm sure. And we watched that. We just binged it. I mean, I remember we would just get coffee and donuts and watch it. But watching it in Boise, Idaho was probably, outside of trying to be somewhere that looked exactly like Twin Peaks, that was probably the best place to do it. Yeah.
No, anytime we went up to McCall, where, you know, that was the beginning of the tree line, where they had really beautiful trees, we'd always bring the Twin Peaks soundtrack with us.
Yes, we would. And we still, this is, we're dating ourselves here, but we had it on a tape deck.
Yeah.
And we, you know, and we just play it and let the other side flip over and play it again. And it fits so perfectly because you're driving up into the foothills of these mountains and you see all the big trees and you're just listening to the Twin Peaks soundtrack. And I mean, nothing else fit as well for that.
But. Yeah. You know, bringing up the Mothman prophecies, though, that I've already said, but that gives me a tremble.
Get the heebie-jeebies.
The heebie-jeebies. But now I also think I should probably conquer that and maybe read that book. And then I can have like another perspective for 2017.
So. I don't remember much about the Mothman, except that he basically showed, whatever it was, showed up when somebody was about to die, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was like a harbinger of death.
Yes.
So.
And so many people have seen it, and that was just chilling to me.
So the chilling part was after you watched the movie and you realized that this is supposedly a real phenomenon?
I think it said it at the beginning, didn't it? And then,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I've blocked it out.
So it kind of brings up the question, is this, you know, whenever they talk about, do they want people to be more scared of the movie because they think that parts of it could have a link to reality? You know, it's kind of like when they say The Exorcist is based on a true story. Yeah, but no. You know, like stuff like there was a kid that was possessed and he was actually a boy, but whatever, you know, and that person is still alive or was in the last couple of decades at any rate. They eventually are going to die of old age, I'm sure. But did the stuff that happened in that movie happen? Probably not. Nobody's head's turning around 360 and doing all this. So some of it might have had some tenuous link with reality. So I just kind of wonder, like with the Mothman prophecies, I'm trying to make it so you can sleep tonight.
Oh, I'll be able to sleep
just
tonight.
Appreciate,
I'll be fine.
Appreciate my effort here.
I appreciate it, but I think I should read the book.
That's on you.
We've got some feedback that came in after the interview, so we're going to get to those next. And so Joel says, feedback on feedback. I wish I had more to contribute here. I should have kept notes on the interviews, but I was enjoying them too much to jot anything down. I do feel like Jubal had a specific question he was hoping others could address, but I can't remember what it was. I even skipped around looking for it again and couldn't find it. Jubal, if you hear this, what was it? John's theory about Andrew Packard had me literally laughing out loud. One of the funniest things I have ever heard about Twin Peaks. I'm chuckling again now, even writing this. It was great to hear Daniel talk in person after corresponding with him so much online, and I was glad Tyler was able to jump on board there at the end. It'll be interesting to see how his Ghost World Girl scenario plays out both in his work and, who knows, maybe elsewhere. This was such a great idea, and thank you for having me as well, even if my interview did run longer than The Godfather. As for the upcoming podcast, all of those ideas sound great, and I'm still rooting for an episode on each Lynch film. Did you guys attempt the access guide? It's definitely slighter than the Coop or Laura book, but if you could pull off the trading cards, you could pull that off. Well, we did. Thanks to John,
we did. We had a little help from our friends, as they say.
Thanks, Joel. All right, next up we've got John. We've got the remainder of his email that he had sent, which we had taken a portion of. That was what made up our access guide coverage. And I'm going to start reading about his what he has said about the interviews here. Okay, he says, Jubal mentioned in his interview the book Full of Secrets, and I'm so glad he did. It's a collection of academic essays edited by David Lavery, who just recently passed away, and I've got more about that from John, actually. That really opened my mind back in 2001 when I read it from cover to cover, and a book I should have touted highly when you asked for my own influences, except my brain was too flustered to be that organized. Full of Secrets was a major stepping stone for me in that before I read it, I watched the show as a fan only, and after I read it, I was able to look at it like art and find new perspectives. I was making the transition on my own, but the book helped speed along the process. In its way, it's as important and eye-opening a book as Brad Duke's Reflections, and I recommend all the serious diehards to take at least one good dive into this book. Jubal also said something about questioning Audrey's fate at the end of the series, so I want to confirm that at her first Twin Peaks Fest appearance, Sherilyn Fend told us how she read the final episode script and then got a phone call from David Lynch himself that assured her she was not being written off the show. He wouldn't tell her how, but he said something along the lines of, "Trust me, some way, somehow, we'll find a way to get her out of that." So yes, even in 1991, it's always been a given that Audrey'd make it out of that bank vault alive. Another idea that struck me as funny was Jubal's remark that the first new episode could be nothing but decrepit old men forgetting shit. And it got me thinking how Ben Horn could potentially fit that bill now. He's up there in age, but not that up there in age. But I could totally see Richard Beamer slowing himself down for some good patience testing comedy. Maybe Johnny Horn, a competent son after all, now that he's done with his emotional troubles and headdress days, will be his seemingly normal caretaker while Audrey is off kicking ass and taking names. And really, maybe Ben could be the new decrepit mayor of the town who doesn't know the microphone's on. Might be better than a mayor Andy Brennan. I can't decide.
I would rather go with Mayor Ben Horn, because Mayor Andy Brennan, while it has definite comedic value, is also pretty cringeworthy. I'm just kind of like, are we ready for that?
And as far as Lynch doubling down on things that the viewers don't necessarily want, I don't think Cooper will be introduced again until right near the end of the first new episode. He wasn't introduced till around the 40-minute mark in the pilot, and now that we absolutely need to see him again, I think it's very possible we won't even see him at all in the first episode. Could you even imagine the audience's response? Give this 60-40 odds. Wow. Yeah, I mean, that would be frustrating not to see him in the first episode, but I could see David Lynch doing that.
I could see that too. I could see a situation where you're waiting, kind of biting your nails to see Cooper, and then you see some of the characters that you either know already or have been introduced in this episode turn towards the door, and then the door opens and somebody who is already familiar with him obviously says, "Cooper?" And then cut to the credits. Just because he can.
John goes on to say, Daniel introduced a fun question into the mix. Which character are we most like? If I were any character, I think I'd be Big Ed or Harry or maybe even a Pete. The stalwart nurturer types always speak to me. And if I were on the production side of things, I feel I'd be a Harley Payton. I would definitely be part of the writer's stable and listening to the Brad Duke show, where Payton guested really hit me right in the instincts. He shared two things that in hindsight he changed so the show would stay on the rails. Mark Frost would never leave to make his movie, which I agree with, as well as probably Frost would, and that Audrey and Cooper should have gotten together. Now, I personally still agree with Kyle MacLachlan that there shouldn't have been a romantic partnership between them, but I do agree that they have a strong enough relationship that Audrey'd have been the one taken into Lodge rather than needing all that scaffolding to make Annie a character, then love interest in 6 episodes or less. Love does not have to relate to sex in every instance, and I think making the assumption otherwise is the show's worst mistake, even over Diane Keaton's defanging of Wyndham Earle. As a father, I guarantee you the love I have for my boys, you know, Cooper and Harry, is easily strong enough that the door to the Lodge would open for me if they were on the other side. And in TV terms, Cooper's platonic love for Audrey would be just as strong, whether he was sleeping with her or not. Need more proof? Try the One-Eyed Jack's rescue mission, which would in hindsight become a real-world reflection of the rescue from the Lodge spirit world as well. What a nice balance that could have been. Yeah, and that was obviously the intent, because the wallpaper was reflective of... The wallpaper was similar to where Laura went in Fire Walk With Me when she... I don't know if it was the intent. I'm just going to put my bet on that it was the intent to be the parallel to that.
I can see that. I mean, I agree with it. I don't have any quibbles with that.
The real world reflection, as John calls it.
You know, I would like to see an interview now in 2016 with Kyle MacLachlan and see if he still agrees with that, with his...
Yeah.
Because people, you know, anytime you have an interview, obviously, it's a snapshot of what that person's thinking at the time. And then things change in their own head. Things change in the real world. The way that they view things evolves, hopefully. You know, we evolve and we change for the better, we hope. But sometimes it's not always that way. I mean, MacLachlan had some sort of moral issue with his character dating somebody that young, even though she would have been, they could have done the story to where she was, you know, well past the 18-year-old mark. And because she could have been 18 years old before she graduated high school. I know I was, you know, for a few weeks at least. And so it would have been legal and everything. But, you know, he had this – anyway, I'll get to the point. What I'm trying to say is he had this moral problem with it. But then this is a guy who a few years later – not more than a few, but some years later down the road goes and does Showgirls, which is a pile of shit if you've ever seen it. So
yeah, but my understanding is he was unhappy with Showgirls. Like, I think he went in thinking it was going to be something else,
like an art house kind of film,
and then he was disappointed when he actually saw the results. So I don't know how true that is.
But. Yeah, but he was still present for when they filmed that pool scene, and it's pretty bad. So I'm just saying, you know, a guy's got to get a paycheck. You know what I mean? I'm not always happy with my job either, but I just wonder if you were to interview Kyle today, if he would have a different take on that, especially given the fact that so many diehard fans of Twin Peaks are, for lack of a better term, shippers for that particular relationship.
John goes on to say, but other than the semantics argument behind the Audrey Cooper relationship, I feel a kinship with how Peyton talks about his process and really how he did his damnedest to put a stamp on two other people's project, ahem. And then I hear him again on the Twin Peaks Unwrapped podcast as well, just to confirm how interesting that guy is. Both interviews are good companions to the other and are must listens. And speaking of Unwrapped, Ben is graciously soundbiting that Andrew Packard theory of mine, to which I'll say again here. Thanks, Ben. Yeah, they obviously, you guys can see how long ago I got this letter.
For my part, I love the Andrew Packard theory. The that's fun stuff. So
yeah, and I actually listened to that Twin Peaks Unwrapped, so I could hear that again. So John says, while I was writing him to iron out the details, something in our exchange made me realize that Sherilyn Fenn will be 52 when the new episodes come out, putting her in not exactly dissimilar territory to Piper Laurie's 58 when Twin Peaks was airing the first time. So something tells me all the Audrey fans who ever said the Catherine Ben Toes thing was unsexy, sexy time might just change their tune a little when we rediscover just how sexy Audrey Horne will always be. Scenes just don't stop being hot after actresses turn 30. You just might not notice this until you get a little older yourself. All this to say, Twin Peaks can Audrey it up any way they want to. I'm down for it. Can I get an amen? Yes, amen. I'm over 30, so totally.
I'm way over 30, so I'll give you an amen. But what you're saying, I'm with you. If there's going to be a scene like that in this new, I'm going to be all for it. But I'm wondering, if I'm being honest, I'm wondering how many people who had watched Piper Laurie's career from the 80s and the 70s and everything else evolve to where it got to in Twin Peaks felt the way about her that we feel about Audrey. Just throwing that out there too. So it's not just about age. It's also about relative levels of sexual attractiveness, you know, and I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not the best looking guy in the world, so I'm not trying to down on anybody's appearance, but I think that's a factor. So, but you still get the amen. How about that?
Yeah, of course. All right, so John goes on to say, I'm glad Daniel brought up the mystery playbook from the book Twin Peaks, an access guide, the last official Twin Peaks release currently not covered by your podcast. Ahem. this is old.
This has been rectified, people. Yes, it's been rectified.
I've got my own thoughts on the mystery play, but I'll save those until the back section of this overly long email where, if you'll indulge me, I'll give you a full-on book report. I know the book's gangly thing to tackle, but it is completely worth discussing. Not to mention I love it dearly despite the book's general lack of seriousness. I'm also glad to Daniel for bringing up the hallmarks of a fairy lore that show similarities to the mythology of the Lodge spirits. I tried to make this point when I brought up changelings, which to me sounded like some fairy stories. But while I got lost in the weeds, he explained his case much better. So thanks for inadvertently covering my ass, Daniel. And also, thanks for mentioning how the theosophy and lore that Frost borrowed from had a circuitous filtered path to the West from its roots in the same Hinduistic well that Lynch's ideas come from. As if, say, they're looking at the same concepts from opposite sides of the same red curtains. It's nice that the creative process is reflected so well in the final product, and it shines a light so easily on how that unexplainable feel of the show grew into what it did. And as far as the mythology in the show happening accidentally rather than being planned from the start, I think that's absolutely true. Mythology just didn't happen on TV back then. Now, maybe the shows like Hitchhiker or Kolchak, the Night Stalker had something like it, but I haven't seen any myself to say. The closest I've seen is The Prisoner, and that was only 17 episodes in the late 1960s, and it more so had rules in place rather than full-on mythology. The fact you can watch all but the first and last two episodes in any order you want, and it'll make the same amount of sense as telling, and so is the fact that it took over 20 years for any show to come along that could remotely compare to it. Here's a way the new Twin Peaks can be modernized while staying on model. There's an anime from the 90s called Lane, where the sound of the electricity and fans of desktop computers were just as effective at being creepy and omnipresent as the hum of fire and the ceiling fan in Twin Peaks. The electric hum of laptops would easily inherit the sense of dread within any of the homes of Twin Peaks. And really, a coffee shop with free Wi-Fi and places to plug in devices would be the perfect place for the new guard of Bookhouse Boys to get things done, because they drink coffee, the engine fuel of all things positive, as well as where the scary characters can listen in like Wyndham Earl did with that bugged bonsai, so that the bad guys will be one step ahead because of all the portals of electricity available. And in this way, a coffee shop could be the perfect real-world representation of the Black and White Lodge. As far as Frost's upcoming book, what are the over-unders for how many wedding announcements will be listed involving Lana Milford? How many birth announcements from characters we know already? Will John Justice Wheeler be mentioned in anything more than the last name of Audrey's first child? And how many pages will be devoted to Major Briggs' obituary? I'm hoping for an entire chapter as they send him off with something hugely heroic the whole town could get behind. And then it could be followed up with a number of stories that show this was the final motivator for Bobby to finally grow the fuck up and stop getting the proverbial cigarettes knocked into the proverbial meatloafs. Have we landed us on meatloaf? Or is it banana bread? Okay, moving on. What is Garland's heroism?
We're here for you, John. We're here for you.
What is Garland's heroism? I suspect it will have something to do with a botched attempt at recovering the true Cooper from the lodge. It'll sound like the major could have been successful, but also there'd be enough room to think it was close but not quite, however valiant the execution. And while I'm on the subject of obituaries, I know they were initially planning on Cooper killing Annie in the third season, possibly even in the hospital, but how interesting would it be if there's no obituary at all for Annie Blackburn, only to find out Cheryl Lee is playing Annie in the new series? Talk about reverberations of the lodge and other resculpting reality moments. Annie could combine with Laura, and the entire town doesn't notice a difference, or even the change itself. It could be that there's no Laura in the new series, and there never was a Laura Palmer. It's like Laura was able to assume this identity shift into a safer, happier character lifestyle when she won against Bob. And if they play with Bob, is he, isn't he, relationship with Cooper, it could be that Annie doesn't know Bob is in him, or that she knows full well Bob is in Cooper. She's there keeping him in check like Cesar Millan, a half-second pfft sound every time Cooper gets the bloodlust in his eyes, and Cooper immediately heals. I only bring up the identity switcheroo because of how I interpreted Mulholland Drive the only time I'd ever watched it. I did not see a dream happening like the popular theories. I saw it like it was literally something that was happening to Naomi Watts' character event following event, and there was a reality warp in the middle. The plot is fuzzy to me right now, and I don't remember how the murder story thread went, but the gist of what I do remember goes something like this. She was living her life. She wasn't exactly thrilled with it. She makes it to that movie theater where she could be going through something like her own form of lodge trial. A decision was arrived at. She becomes someone else entirely, and she spends the rest of the movie living through the repercussions of her true nature's decision. I could completely see Laura being remanifested into a new life and completely overriding the wooden, rather empty Miss Blackburn, while the entire town of Twin Peaks is none the wiser. Except, of course, for that spooky, unhinged town weirdo Sarah Palmer, who could be the only person who remembers the continuity the way we know it, not to mention that she had a daughter at all. This is also unlike how in Grant Morrison's Animal Man, Psycho Pirate is the only character who remembers the story continuity of DC Comics before the Crisis of Infinite Earth redid everything, thus making him have a ton in common with the readers, but also drives him mad in an asylum because his whole world isn't what he believes to be the truest real.
I really like this idea. I really like this idea because I don't read DC Comics, but I understand that they rebooted their universe sometime back, and they kept a character that remembered everything, but nobody else remembers they are and what they are, and that is genius to me. And so if they did something like that with Twin Peaks, Sarah Palmer would be the perfect candidate mm-hmm. to be that person who remembered it. It would have been the Log Lady if she had survived, you know, but I think Sarah Palmer fits it just as well. And that would be great. If not that storyline, I could totally see Laura Palmer being somebody else. You know, she has a husband, she has a family, she has this life, and this was her reward for overcoming. This was her reward for taking it to the end like she did, and just ass kicking, you know, and living through all that. Like, you, that's your light at the end of the tunnel. You get to be kind of reborn into this different life where things turn out positive for you. So instead of being wrapped up in these nasty sexual relationships with what may or may not be your father, but kind of is, in the whole nine yards. It's like you get something pure and wholesome that you love and that you can be behind, but maybe there's a nasty after effect where she maybe can kind of remember some of the stuff that happens, or she starts to regain snippets of that memory. And I don't know, I'm just kind of wildly speculating here, but ideas along that path really intrigue me.
John goes on to say, what are the odds that Laura and Annie combine quite like that? I give it a straight 50-50. Entertaining, could work, but in a way is almost too much of a cop-out by how it sweeps away the framework for exploring the moral culpability of Laura's murderers before it could be properly explored in this new context. Well, I mean, Heather Graham's not coming back.
Yeah.
So
she must be really busy.
Well, I mean, they maybe decided that the story didn't need her, so maybe John's on to something here. As far as how this figures into Tyler's feedback, where he mentions the Lynch interviewing Laura video where she talks about being in the lodge the entire time, I think something along these lines could still work. I know a number of us have thought Bob would be able to inhabit more than one body at a time, so why couldn't Laura be in two places at once, especially as seeing that time works so noticeably different in there? I could see Laura being trapped in the lodge the whole time while still being a character in the town of Twin Peaks, even if it's a standard doppelganger situation, exactly like Cooper's double presence in the series finale. And back to Annie Blackburn. I'd like to agree with Tyler that Annie never got a fair shake. She was a perfectly reasonable character to introduce, but because she was only supposed to exist in 6 episodes and then be sacrificed as Bob's next kill, she was not allowed to become what her potential could have been. I know I said this in my feedback before, but I think Annie actually was a good match for Cooper. Except the only way their relationship could have worked is if it was built slowly and organically, as was done between Cooper and Audrey, a little bit per episode instead of the whirlwind of love that we got out of necessity. Diving in like that didn't seem like Annie, and it didn't feel like Cooper should be that kind of guy either. The way I look at Annie's squash potential is the main reason why I think it could be interesting to have Cheryl Lee embody her, because that would finally redeem the character as well as Cooper's interest in her. Why? Because if you have Cheryl Lee play a character today, that's proof a character is important. Tyler doesn't want any Laura Palmer figure to be murdered in the new episodes, and I don't either, nor do I expect something like this to be the main hook. I think the main hook is Cooper the good Cooper, or is he Bob? And how much of each will he be? There probably will be a new murder or two, but I think it'll have less to do with who is the victim and it will with the who is the perpetrator. Based on all the Dexters and Breaking Bads out there focusing on a bad guy who happens to be the protagonist, I could see the show's focus easily shifted away from being exclusively pointed at the victim. Really, you could take a look at the show's new arc through a Star Wars lens. The new show could be all about rebirth of Dale Cooper after he become the Darth Vader of the piece by allowing Bob access to him. It could be he's the bad guy through all of the new episodes, only to die as himself in the final minutes as Twin Peaks is ready to explode, and it's up to his newly discovered child to load him onto the Imperial shuttle to give Dale a proper burial in Pittsburgh. Wait, this new series could be the perfect way for Lynch to finally direct Return of the Jedi his way, and we get to see it. What a genius. Daniel, you might get your wish of being in that reality after all. But seriously, if the show really is about Bob finally losing control to Cooper in the end, I hope Dale's first new line as himself again is, "How long have I been out?" And Tyler, the idea about Bob being a force more so than straight up evil, I think you've hit it on the head. Nice call. Under the heading of the More Great Twin Peaks Podcasts, the better, I should mention there's finally another Twin Peaks spoiler cast on the block, Dear Meadow Radio. It has 7 episodes so far, and keep in mind this email was sent a while ago. And my gut says that this is a real deal and should be special. I've written the man in charge to make sure he knew about Unwrapped and Sparkwood, just in case he was accidentally planning to use similar show formulas. You're like the steward of podcasts.
A little bit. Hey, watch it, bud. This is what we already got going on, so stay in your wheelhouse.
John says, to Ben, a room service waiter, quote, "He's heard about you." And Mark assures me he's taken a majorly different path, and so far it sounds like he's taken a different path from everyone. For one thing, he's not doing an episode recap per podcast. His first show covered his own personal Twin Peaks story and Twin Peaks journey itself through broadcast television and film, and the next few revolve around the inspirations behind the pilot, including in-depth information about Lynch and Frost's early projects and pre-Twin Peaks collaborations, trying to make connections with what will take root and show up later in Twin Peaks. It's the latest episode that begins to dig into the first part of the pilot, and he's still got plenty of that pilot left to cover in further episodes. So as you might imagine, Mark is digging into a lot of seldom covered details. Being a fellow there from the beginning guy and a fan who wants to be digging into the early influences but doesn't have enough time to do it properly myself, I love what Mark's doing here. Dear Meadow Radio is a nice addition to the podcast landscape, and I highly recommend everyone take a listen.
I like the fact that there's so many different Twin Peaks podcasts out there. You know, you've got The Way We Did It, which is just spoiler from the beginning for the people who've seen it, the veterans, kind of, so to speak, and people who already are in love with it, and they can listen to something that, you know, on their way to work and use this for however we got used, you know. Yeah. You know, and then there's the newbie podcast, which is always popular. And then there's the people who dissect it from a point of view of being inside the industry to some certain degree. And there's people who go for a really scholarly kind of outlook, which we didn't necessarily do. And then, like, you know, I don't know, there's just so many different angles you can approach this show from. It lends itself to all of this variety.
Yeah.
You know, like you really weren't going to be able to do this with Family Ties or something like
well,
that.
Of course not.
You know, I'm just saying there's a lot of shows out there that you would not be able to do this with. There's one way to approach it or two ways to approach it possibly, and that's it. And everybody's doing a retread of everybody else. There's just room for all of these different diverging sort of approaches to this in the Twin Peaks world, and it's really great that I just feel honored to be a part of that. You know, I just feel good to be a part of something that when people say, hey, if you're thinking about Twin Peaks podcasts, you know, maybe you should listen to some other ones first and make sure you check out Sparkwood in 21.
We're just podcasters anyway, and we couldn't pass up discussing Twin Peaks. It kind of grew beyond what our expectations were. You know, we did more with it than we had originally set out.
A lot more with it. I mean, yeah. When we first set out to do it, I knew that we were going to do every single episode, and then we were going to do the movie, you know, and then with the pilot at the beginning and the whole 9 years. I knew that was a given, but the branch out afterwards, the search for new material, you know, culminating really in the interviews was, even though we've done material since then, but that was, I think that was the big bang right there, was those interviews. And this was Em's idea, and it was genius, if I don't say so myself. And it worked out better than anybody could have expected. And I think we, you know, the legacy that I want Sparkwood and 21 to have on Twin Peaks podcasts is the bringing together of Twin Peaks fans.
Yeah, the community.
The community mm-hmm. part of it, to where all these really, really big time fans who didn't know about each other before got to know each other because we were reading their letters in the feedback section, and then they started communicating with each other, and then now they don't need us anymore. They've got their direct lines, you know? They know each other's email addresses, and that's great. I love that.
This was different than the rest of our podcast. It was more tightly compacted in a way. Maybe because it's just you and I. I don't know if that is part of it.
That had an effect for sure.
And we were able to, since we had a smaller interaction with the handful of people who were writing in consistently, we were able to interview them and then and kind of solidify that whole community idea that I think this podcast has grown into. So we have Michael, who wrote in recently, and he says, "Hi, Em and Steve. I'm a Twin Peaks fan in the UK who has recently started listening to the Sparkwood and 21 podcast in my car during my daily commute. Thanks for keeping me company. I'm up to the episode where Leland kills Maddie, so I've still got plenty of catching up to do. I'm interested in supporting the podcast using your Amazon link. I think it's a great way to give something back just by buying things that I already wanted anyway. I buy quite a lot through Amazon and would happily click through your site if you had an Amazon UK link on there. Are you considering becoming Amazon UK affiliates as well as .com? Thanks and keep up the good work, Michael." I will attempt to do this again, Michael. I've actually had a UK link on our site before, but it never fully... like every time I applied and went through the process, it kept telling me my website was not finished. And it's like, my website is fucking finished. I don't know what the hell.
Thank you very much.
What, you know, and so I don't know what was going on with that, but maybe I could try it again and see how it works. It's been a while, so I will try to do that.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for the nice letter. And since you're listening to us on your way to work, I assume that you're driving. Don't be alarmed, but you are on the wrong side of the road right now.
And wrong side of the car.
Yeah.
We have John who ties us up by honoring David Lavery, who recently passed away. And he says, I mentioned the book Full of Secrets in my feedback section, and it might be worth a mention of condolences while you're there, since it was reported earlier this week. The main guy on the book, David Lavery, has died. This book was big for John Thorne and pretty much anyone who's read it. So definitely sad news for the Twin Peaks community. And on the other hand, we have that new Eddie Vedder song, which this Pearl Jam guy likes and is purportedly part of the upcoming Twin Peaks. Says it was recorded on June 10th, which was 25 years to the day of the series finale. I swear I'm done filling up your inbox this time around. Take care and happy recording, John. Yeah, I saw a link where you could click on where you could listen to that song, but the heading above it says, or you can wait to the proper time when it shows up on Twin Peaks. And I was like, I think I'll wait for the proper time to listen to that song. So I decided to follow directions.
So this is an Eddie Vedder solo work.
I guess so.
That's mm-hmm. going to be part of the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. So this is really going to happen then, since Eddie Vedder is involved. Because, you know, I know it's going to happen, but I just feel like we've been... here we are, we're in the beginning of September in 2016, and it feels like, I know it hasn't been this long, but it feels like it's been a couple of years now that we've been talking about when this is going to take place, and it keeps getting pushed up, and it keeps mutating in form. First, it's going to be a straight-up season, or it seems that way now. Then you hear people throw around the term miniseries. Then I've heard other people talk about maybe a movie. I don't know if there's any credence to that, but I want this book to come out, basically, because that, to me, will be the real...
The Frost book?
The Frost book, yeah, because I feel like that'll be the cementing factor that says, okay, this is real, this is actually going to happen, we're going to get some more Twin Peaks, because up until now, it's almost like when your mom tells you that she's going to take you to the, you know, to the mall or something when you're a little kid, and you're just like, yeah, right, and then it isn't real till you get in the car and start heading up the road. Not that my mom ever took me to the mall when I was little. That's just the first thing that popped into my head. Maybe Toys R Us would be better.
Fill in the blank.
So yeah, fill in the blank. Everybody has that special place they like to go to.
Well, I'm glad we covered this feedback. So the next thing we're going to be covering will be Wild at Heart.
Yeah.
I believe. And then after that, it should be Mark Frost's book.
Hopefully.
Yeah. And so
after Wild at Heart, if we, you know, whether the book comes out or not within the proper time frame, I think we should go for Mulholland Drive after that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, we could still even probably fit Mulholland Drive in before that. But yeah, we'll definitely do that. And
for those of you who are listening to this and don't realize, we on other parts of the No Ship Network website, we cover movies sometimes, and we're going to be covering pretty much most, if not all, of David Lynch's works.
But all of David Lynch's works still gets uploaded onto the Sparkwood and 21 feed.
That's right. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah. So it gets uploaded on two feeds. That's the only one I do that.
Yeah, that
with.
Makes sense. It makes sense, though. Yeah.
All right. Well, that was it. Thank you guys for writing in. It was nice to introduce Carl and Mike to everybody, and then also have Joel and John come back and comment on the interviews that we did. Feel free to write in some more. We may still be able to do another feedback podcast before we get to 2017. I'm sure you guys are going to write feedback in for Wild at Heart as well as Mulholland Drive, and even write it in before if you want to contribute. Write it in after, because those movies take so long to just record our coverage of that. We probably wouldn't include feedback at the time anyway. We would just follow up with feedback.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Feedback would be a separate podcast later on down the road. Because we'd like to do a few more of these, you know, before the season 3 actually comes out, just to kind of hit the refresh button on Sparkwood and 21 and keep it in everybody's minds.
But this fall we are going to be covering two shows, so
The fall will be a little bit slim as far as Twin. This may be the last Twin Peaks or Sparkwood and 21 transmission that we do for a little bit, because we're going to be doing Ash versus Evil Dead season 2 and Vikings 4.2.
What, this one? Well, we're going to do Wild at Heart before then.
Well, I mean, as far as just straight up Twin Peaks stuff, you know?
Oh, straight up Twin Peaks. Yeah. Okay. All right. That's it for now. We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds. And we will see you under the sycamore tree.
I'm your host, Em.
I'm your host, Steve.
For more information about our podcast, as well as our membership program, go to our website at noship.net.